I'm happy to welcome you all to the October hearings. We have with us this morning for the 9:45 case, Whitnall High School. Welcome. And Albany High School. Welcome to you all. And now that the court has met you, I'd like you to meet the court. Starting on my far right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to her left is Justice John Wilcox. And to my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. I'm Shirley Abrahamson. I'm the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice William Babbage. And to his left, Justice Jeanine Geske. And to her left, Justice Patrick Crooks. There are materials about the court in the foyer, as well as summaries of the cases that will be heard today, and you are welcome to pick them up. And with those introductions made, one other comment. The classes will meet with retired Chief Justice Roland Day at noon, who will discuss the procedures of the court, and you will be joined then by students from Edison Middle School and Lutheran Atonement. Okay, I'll call the first case, 95-2733, Tomchek versus Bailey. Mr. Fox, are you prepared? You're ready.
Okay.
All right. You were introduced by song on the computer.
May it please the court, my name is Stephen Fox, and I represent the appellant's petitioners this morning, Pete L. Bailey and American Surveying Company. The issue this court is presented with this morning is whether the discovery rule set out in the case of Hansen versus A.H. Robbins is applicable to a claim against a surveyor where a statute of repose specifically states otherwise. In other words, that the claim against the surveyor must be barred any time after 6 years following the completion of the survey. Hansen teaches us that there's a general rule and an exception to it. The general rule is that all tort claims are governed by the discovery rule. The exception that Hansen is illustrating is that legislatively created discovery rules are exempt from application of the judicially created discovery rules. In other words, the court in Hansen gave credence and respect to what the legislature did insofar as deeming certain claims to accrue on dates other than discovery. So in other words, Hansen specifically tells us that it doesn't apply, the discovery rule does not apply to legislatively created discovery rules. So that the claims that the Tomczaks have presented us with can only succeed if this court rules that the surveyor statute, section 893.37, means something contrary than what its plain language says it means. This court has to rule that the language in the statute with respect to completion of a survey doesn't mean that. It means discovery of a survey error. The Court of Appeals in this case has ruled that a statute to be a legislatively created discovery rule must expressly recite discovery language. This ruling flies in the face of what this court said in Hansen. When Hansen spoke of legislatively created discovery rules, it gave us an example. It gave us the example of section 893.55, the medical malpractice statute. Said that statute is a legislatively created discovery rule. But therefore, if that is the case, the surveyor statute also must be a legislatively created discovery rule. Because the surveyor statute and the medical malpractice statute have an analogous substantive effect on a claim brought by someone suing a doctor or suing a surveyor, with the exception that the medical malpractice statute is actually far more restrictive than the surveyor statute in that it bars claims made 5 years after the medical error or omission.
Mr. Fox, let me interrupt for a minute. This case, as I understand it, came before the trial court on a motion for summary judgment brought by your client. Is that correct?
Correct.
Did the trial judge find that there were genuine issues of material fact when he denied that summary judgment motion?
He did not, and I think the question is directed at, was there an issue with respect to when the claim was discovered? The court
That's right.
didn't make it that far. The court simply ruled that the discovery rule applied, period.
Now, what happens if you go back and you find out that the error was discovered 2, 3, 4, 6 months, whatever, before the six-year statute ran?
In other words, what happens when the court determines that discovery occurred before the six-year period of repose
ran? Right.
Well, then I think that the court has to find that, The court will then, the trial court is going to tell me in that case that the Tomczaks had 6 years from the date of discovery to sue Mr. Bailey and his company.
Regardless of when the discovery occurred. What I'm really getting at is that the case may be raise a moot legal issue if you say, well, you discovered it within 6 years, you're tied to 6 years. It's only when you discover after 6 years that you have a further statute.
Judge Flynn, I don't think, made that distinction. I think what he was saying was that the six-year period in the statute commences running on discovery. So you've got 6 years after that, even if the period of repose intervenes.
Did he make a finding of the date of discovery?
He did not make any finding like that.
Is there any dispute as to that date?
One of the admissions that you'll find in the respondent's response brief is that they became aware of a discrepancy with their boundaries in approximately June of 1994. And I think it's relevant that that date is approximately 3 months prior to the time when the period of repose ran.
The argument then of your opposing counsel is, let's say in a six-year period, if the boundary problem was discovered 4 years into that six-year period, your opposing counsel's argument would be that's when the 6 years begins to run. Is that correct?
Exactly.
So the problem, as some may view it, that it was discovered 2 months prior to the running of the six years, is of no consequence under your interpretation of opposing counsel's argument.
I think that's correct.
They could have discovered it 3 years after the event. They could have discovered it 5 years after the event. And whenever they discovered it, it's your opposing counsel's argument that then the 6 years starts.
They could have discovered it generations later, and only then does the six-year period start to run.
Let me ask, because if they did discover it let's say 10 years later, then the landowner, hypothetically, would have an adverse possession claim, which is another statute, and would be able to, regardless, I'm talking about remedy here, would have the remedy of adverse possession once that was met, whether it was 10 years or it's 20-year statute, that I held this for 20 years, and we all thought the survey stakes were correct, even though they were incorrect. So in some cases, the landowner would have redress or a remedy, even though there had been a survey problem. That's correct?
That's correct, and I think it's important to note that the surveyor statute is juxtaposed in Chapter 893 with the rest of the adverse possession statutes. It's not in the subchapter entitled Limitations on Tort Actions. It's in the subchapter entitled Other Real Estate Actions. Now, the way that the Tomczaks and the Court of Appeals in this case interpret Hansen makes Hansen's exception for legislatively created discovery rules surplusage. The Toms Act and the Court of Appeals have said that a legislatively created discovery rule has to expressly recite discovery language. If that's the case, then this court could have stopped in Hansen with the judicially created discovery rule and made no exception, because whether it's a legislatively created discovery rule as asserted by the Toms Act or whether it's another discovery rule, the claim accrues on discovery. So the exception in Hansen is completely unnecessary and can't be used because the discovery rule, the judicially created discovery rule, has the exact same effect. So that's why I think that the court actually meant to do something when it carved out the exception for legislatively created discovery rules. I don't think that the court's ruling should be deemed to be surplusage.
Do you know how many statutes of repose, ballpark figure, we have?
Well, I know that in 1979, when Chapter 8, number 893 was amended, there were at least 10 other statutes of repose on the books at that point in time. And I believe that there may be several more. Specifically, one that comes to mind is the statute applicable to claims against certified public accountants.
Do any of the other statutes of repose of which you are aware have specific expressed language regarding a discovery rule other than MedMap?
The Builder's Statute, Section 893.89, which was amended, recreated in 1994, I believe, has that kind of language. But again, the discovery language in the Builder's Statute as it currently exists says only if the claim is discovered within 6 months before the period of repose of 10 years ends, is the period of repose of 10 years extended for, I believe, an additional year. So ultimately, the period of repose in the Builder's Statute swallows the limited discovery rule in that statute.
So the holding, if we were to follow the arguments of your opposing counsel, is it your position that our holding would apply to all statutes of repose that do not have express language regarding discovery rule or do not have express public policy discussion?
I think it has to if you rule that this statute of repose is really a discovery rule, because the effect of the statute of repose is the same in every statute of repose. It's just a matter of questioning when the period actually runs. Is it 5 years? Is it 6 years? Is it seven?
Why don't you define what you mean by statute of repose?
I'll look to the Leverance case that the Court of Appeals decided in 1990, I believe, for that definition. According to that case, and I agree with it, a period of repose is a time period in which one can sue a defendant that begins running with the act or omission of that specific defendant.
Rather than
a statute of limitations, which in the statute simply says that the period commences upon accrual of the cause of action, and you look to case law to define that.
Okay, so under the case law, you define accrual, or some cases that define accrual, to mean date of discovery.
Correct.
Rather than or in addition to the date of the conduct.
Rather than the date of conduct, I believe, yes.
And in this statute, 893.37, it says no action can be brought against a surveyor to recover damages for negligence in the making of a survey more than 6 years after the completion of the survey. Right?
Correct.
So you're saying 6 years and you're out, even if you don't find out about it. You have no way of finding out about it. You have six surveys in a month. They all say the same thing. You're sure that those are the correct boundary lines. 6 years pass, you find out they're all wrong because they all started from the same point, which was wrong. And you're out of luck.
Absent any...
You did everything right, but you're out of luck.
Absent any constitutional infirmity, which I'm assuming
about
we're going
to
get to.
About. Okay, let's talk about...
That's correct. That's what the legislature has said public policy is.
All right, tell us why you think this is not constitutionally infirm. It sounds bad to me, because if I build on my neighbor's land, depending on the survey, that they've been consuming, right?
That they've been what? I'm sorry.
That might, well, what happened here is that these people built on the wrong land, right?
Or in part.
Part of their house is on the wrong land. Part of the construction on the wrong land. How many years does the adjacent landowner have to sue?
The adjacent landowner, I believe, under 893.33, has 30 years to address that encroachment.
So I build on his property. I build on Justice Babbage's property because the surveyor made a mistake. I'm not at fault. I got 6 years to get him. And Justice Babbage has got 30 years to sue me. How, that doesn't sound like fairness.
Your lawsuit against Justice Babbage is an equitable claim. And that's why the common law provides equitable defenses. I cannot conceive of a situation where your lawsuit would be estopped, or your where Justice Babbage's would have the defense of estoppel or waiver, because that property that encroached was done with his knowledge, because he knows where his boundary lines are.
Mr. Fox, what rational basis is there for that distinction between the adjoining landowner and the surveyor?
I think there are a number of them.
Now you're moving into an equal protection argument, right?
Correct.
Okay.
First of all, the surveyor statute has the ultimate effect of deterring the kind of encroachments we've been talking about. Because only the property owner, not the surveyor, can be subject to injunctive relief of a court. If the surveyor statute were able to be raised by a defendant property owner as a defense, the adverse possession statutes would be absolutely eviscerated. Only that property owner can be ordered by a court to remove or move the encroachment. And if that property owner could raise the statute as a defense, you've got a six-year statute. You've got a six-year adverse possession period.
That's right. I mean, what you say is correct under the law, but why does that make it rational to give Babbage 30 years to sue me, but then I can't go after my surveyor, who's Justice Steinmetz, because the 6 years have passed. So here I am. I've got to destroy that house, right? Or else I've got to buy the land from him. And yet, the guy who's at fault, you will excuse this, right? Goes home and keeps all the money from the survey.
The legislature has given some claims higher consideration. And the claim that they've given higher consideration in this case is the claim to remove the encroachment.
But it has to have a rational basis to survive an equal protection challenge. What is that rational basis?
I believe that the rational basis is exactly that.
You're making a circular argument, sir. If you say that the rational basis is that the legislature thought that surveyors were more, that Justice Steinmetz was more important than Justice Babbage, I mean, that's not a reason, that's simply a conclusion. What is the reason why surveyors need more protection than a landowner?
Additionally, a surveyor, a surveying company, can perform hundreds of surveys every year. The typical landowner sells a piece of real estate, in this case, a piece of residential real estate, once every several years. The financial effect on the surveyor could be far more disastrous than the financial effect on a landowner. And I think that's also a rational basis for making the distinction in the classification. Ultimately, the statute is good for consumers, because I think you're going to find surveyors retiring and practicing their profession elsewhere if this statute is deemed constitutionally infirm.
Well, the surveyor, of course, could protect him or herself by purchasing the insurance, just like we have title insurance, you'd have survey insurance, and isn't that a way for them to protect themselves?
It certainly is, and again, one can only imagine what the cost of Arizona emissions insurance for an engineer or surveyor is going to skyrocket to in the event that this statute is deemed unconstitutional.
So once we, if we were to say that we find that there is no rational basis and that would be the decision of this court, 50 years from now, a person could technically bring an action if, of course, a survey company might not be in business at that time, but if they had insurance, wouldn't that insurance go with that survey so there'd be someone to look to? Wouldn't that be a rational way to handle this?
I think it would depend on the kind of errors of emissions insurance in place. Most policies like that I've encountered are claims-made policies. In other words, you have to make the claim within the policy period. Otherwise, you don't have an action against that insurance company.
Justice Wilcox's question to me with regard to the 50 years or so a claim can be brought raises concerns of finality. It seems to me that there is a policy reason to be advanced about finality vis-a-vis property disputes. And you offer many reasons for a rational basis. I think you list 6 or 7 or 8. And of those that you list, this long tail argument that you make seems to me the most compelling, much like Justice Wilcox suggests. If you follow opposing counsel's argument, if it isn't discovered, this incorrect survey isn't discovered for 50 years, 70 years, maybe it's been, the family has had the property for 70 years, a cause of action can still be maintained 70 plus 6 years. Is there some argument to be advanced that having that kind of exposure vis-a-vis surveyors is inconsistent with public policy?
Well, it certainly is, and that's in the plain language of the surveyor statutes. That's why we have periods of repose, because I don't believe that the legislature intended or that it's good public policy that one would be able to start an action generations later. And as far back as, I believe, sometime in the 1880s or 90s, this court acknowledged that the very old subdivision plats, the very old surveys, going back to the time this state was a territory, were often inaccurate. And under the plaintiff's position as to the surveyor statute, a surveying company that is in existence and continues past the life of a surveyor can still be sued generations later, even though the technology has completely changed, and those kind of claims, I think, essentially are contrary to public policy. How is it possible to defend against a claim that was made, that arises out of a survey that was made generations prior to the date the action is commenced?
Could you distinguish the Funk case then from, and why the Funk case doesn't require us to come to the same conclusion vis-a-vis this statute?
What was it, the question, how I distinguish the case?
Yes.
Our job is a little more difficult in this case, because in the Funk case, the legislature specified one rational basis. The legislature said that there's a control problem with respect to the builder statute and contractors and engineers that are subject to it. Because after the contractors, subcontractors, engineers leave the project site, there's no more control, and the contractor can be liable for negligent control by the owner and be sued for that negligent control. That's what the legislature specifically said with respect to that statute. But the court, and I think accurately, said that's an artificial distinction, because a contractor, an engineer, can never be held liable for the owner's negligent maintenance. So I think that's one of the primary differences. And, of course, the fact that there are different rational bases to protect a surveyor instead of an owner.
But finality fits into both those, do they not?
As to the surveyor and the owner?
as to the surveyor and also as to the parties that were protected in the statute in the Funk case.
It certainly does, but I read the briefs in the Funk case. No argument other than the control argument was advanced by the builder, and I think that constrained what happened in that case.
Well, counsel, you offered as a rational basis that a surveyor has a lot of jobs to do, and so the exposure is great, and they simply would flee the state in droves. Well, what about John Smith Construction Company? John Smith Construction Company, with a lot of jobs, maybe puts up 10 houses in a year, or 10 buildings in a year, and yet we've said that date of discovery applies.
But we really haven't said that. The court may have said that, but then the legislature stepped in and provided a 10-year period of repose subject to a very limited date of discovery rule, which can only extend that 10-year period by, it was either 6 months or a year. So I think, no, the period of repose is still applicable to builders, and rightly so.
So how does that new statute differ with the one in Funk?
It did provide the protection to the additional parties that weren't protected under the old statute.
The owner intended. That was the point. So the point was that you had a new statute that covered everybody, gave everybody the same treatment, therefore it met equal protection guarantees. So how does that fit with this statute that doesn't cover everybody?
You can't cover everyone against a claim arising out of a negligent survey that would create absurd results, and I'll specifically draw your attention back to the adverse possession argument.
Thank you, counsel. We'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Bickler?
May it please the court. My name is Robert Bickler. I'm the law firm of Hostack, Hensel, and Bickler. With me is Brenda Stugelmeier of our firm. I will handle the oral arguments. I will respond to some of the questions raised. The factual question is undisputed. There's no issue that this was first learned in June of 1994.
Within the 6 years.
Within the 6 years, correct. Suit was brought the following year.
I'm sorry, did you say that there is no factual issue? It is undisputed that you learned of it in June? Is that what you said?
That's correct. June of 1994, the Tomzaks learned of it. I didn't.
Yes.
I undertook this case in September.
Okay. Got it. June of 1994, and the 6 years ran from the act in August of 94. Is that correct?
That's correct. Undisputed fact, so we can work with that record. The issues then that the court was discussing, number one is that I think we have to go to what the court said in Hansen after addressing the statutes at that time on what it meant by the adoption of the discovery rule. And this court said, with the exception of 893.55, which was the med malpractice at that time for medical malpractice claims, the Wisconsin statutes do not speak to this issue. And the issue that the court said exists and we are adopting now is that an inherent aspect to every cause of action is the knowledge of knowing of its existence. Justice Heffernan quoted Justice Frank, I think, in saying you can't kill it, or it can't die before it's conceived.
Well, Mr. Bickler, some might argue that the issue in Hansen was the meaning of the word accrual. What does accrual mean? How would you answer that?
As I read Hansen, it says that we now deem, I happen to have argued the Rod case up here, in which at that time the court was saying that the action accrues at the time of the injury when the four-year-old boy had the surgery. And that's how a cause, that's what composes a cause of action, wrong and damage. Now the cause of action consists of wrong, damage, and knowledge, or ability to know of its existence, because that's inherent in the administration of justice.
Well, let me try to make the question clear, because you haven't answered it yet. A number of statutes use the term accrual.
Right.
A number of statutes don't use the word at all, but simply talk about when the contract was made, or what, they talk about a specific date. And are you saying that even those statutes, that Hansen was applied, that we intended that Hansen would apply across the board, or just to those statutes that use the word accrual?
I think it applies to tort actions. Limited to tort actions.
Mr. Bickler, wasn't the issue that was certified in Hansen, it was when the cause of action accrues within the meaning of the statute, and when the opinion began, the opinion began with the language, basically, there are three points in time when a tort claim may be set to accrue.
Right. And then the court adopted the latter, which says that at the time of the knowledge.
But the statute itself dealt with the date of accrual, that the action ran a certain period of time after the date of accrual. Was that not the language in the statute of limitations that was at issue? As opposed to the date of the act, or the date of the surgery, or the date of the injury.
I don't recall a specific statute.
Let me try it somewhat differently. As best I remember, Hansen is a medical malpractice.
Right, the Dalton Shield case.
And the statute language was approved. That was 83. Then the issue, if I remember it, but you should correct me, is did the discovery rule apply to non-medical malpractice cases? And then we got Borrello, which was that furnace. Remember?
That's later.
Right. That was 86.
That's a knowable issue.
Pardon me?
That really addresses knowability.
Yeah, but we then said discovery applies more than just to medical malpractice, but to tort cases. Now, those are all statutes that deal with accrual. Now you're asking us to move to a statute that has a specific date mentioned, which is the date of the completion of a survey. Now, you might argue when the survey was completed, when they put in the stakes, when they put the red flag on, when they put in the certificate. I mean, you can get all sorts of discussions about that. But how do you get to read in discovery when it says absolutely clearly completion of the survey?
I want to correct the assumption that you made.
Okay, good.
And I'll read from Hansen. In the interest of justice and fundamental fairness, we adopt the discovery rule for all tort actions other than those already governed by the legislative created discovery rule. And in earlier in the decision, the court said that the only one that had addressed it so far.
Read the next sentence.
Such tort claims accrue on the date of injury is discovered, or with reasonable diligence should have been discovered, whichever occurs first. That's
so again, it's interpreting the date of accrual, is it not? I mean, it goes on to talk again. I mean, the whole holding of Hansen is the court has the power to establish when claims accrue. And I guess if your argument is that we don't have to look at the language that the chief has referred to and simply say the tort claims, regardless of the language of the statute, you use the discovery rule because we say when they accrue or when they give rise as opposed to the legislature.
Right. And the ultimately the reason is that we say our job, the court's job, is to administer individual justice. And we have to define what is a cause of action. And we have done that now in Hansen and tort cases to say what is a cause of action. And it has three components: wrong, damage, and notice. So you're not locked out of the courthouse before you have had notice or ability to get there. So that's the universal rule. Now, then the issue comes, we got policy considerations that are going on down the hall. And they are going to grapple with this issue, and I like to refer to it as positioning, the fulcrum, and how you administer justice. And at what point do you position that fulcrum to the point where the person's right to a remedy is outweighed by some policy considerations which the legislature has specifically grabbed and grappled with and weighed so this court doesn't have to do it.
Counsel, do I understand, let me rephrase that, is your position that for all tort claims, that functionally there is no difference between a statute of repose and a statute of limitations unless the statute of limitations expressly states it?
That's, I think, what Hansen has...
Is that your position?
I believe so. I don't think it's necessary for this case decision to go in our face.
Now, it seems to me that you want the benefit of statute of limitations, that is, discovery rule a la Hansen, without the negative. You've conceded at the outset that your clients discovered this injury in June of 1994, 2 months before the running of the statute of repose. Yet if this were a statute of limitations and it was discovered 2 months before the running of the statute of limitations, you'd be out. Am I correct?
I don't think you'd be out because under the Hansen rule, the cause of action accrues with discovery. We were able to sue poor Mrs. Wolford, her lot.
Okay, I'm getting to it now. I understand, I think, your position. Is it that with a statute of limitations, let's say we have an ordinary 3-year auto accident negligence case, 3-year statute of limitations, if for some reason the injury, and hypothetically, if for some reason the negligence, maybe auto accident doesn't fit into it. If for some reason, in a normal negligence case, you don't discover your injury until 2 months before the running of the statute of limitations. Statute of limitations is a 3-year statute of limitations. Is it your position that the statute of limitations then is extended 3 years, that the injured party doesn't have to bring it in within the first 3 years, but has 3 years from the date of discovery, even if discovered within the original 3 years? Is that your position?
I think the burden shifts. Technically, generally, yes, under the Hansen discovery rule. Every tort accrues at the time a person knows or should know.
So your understanding of the law of statute of limitations is, if an injury is discovered within 3 years of statute of limitations, then from the point that it's discovered, the injured party has 3 additional years to bring it, even though it was initially discovered within the time period. That's your understanding of the law?
That's my understanding of the Hansen case, that now an essential component for every cause of action is knowing or knowability of that cause of action. Now, you go past the 3 years, you've got a problem, you better be able to come in and show that you've got the type of case. And I think the people who were sued in this case who didn't have a fence that points up the lack of equal protection is the former landowner. This was basically a misrepresentation of boundary case when we put it in a nutshell. The surveyor said it's wrong. He misrepresented it. He hides behind the repose of the 6-year statute. Mrs. Wolford has got strict liability in pointing out those survey stakes and said, that's my property. And the real estate agent, they pointed out and said, that's her property. Strict liability and misrepresentation that accrued at the time the Tomczaks found their heir, that they first learned that wasn't their property. The causes of action against Mrs. Wolford, the cause of action against Equitable Stefaniak, the cause of action against every tortfeasor I submit accrued when the Tomczaks found out that they unfortunately built their house on the wrong ground.
Yeah, now the problem that I asked opposing counsel is this. Now you throw on top of that the adverse possession statutes, which now have the issue now becomes one of equity. It's a special law that says that a landowner under color of title of law or ultimately 20 years adverse possession, even though he didn't or she didn't own the land, they can claim it under adverse possession. Now, how in your fulcrum that you described, that fits into this whole situation. So it, doesn't it become muddied if the client, your client, had owned this hypothetically for...
I wish they had owned it for 20 years.
Well, or 10 years, under color of title of law. 10 years could have claimed this. So you have this six-year statute of repose, and then, well, then there's a four-year before they get up to the 10. So, but after they've owned it for 10, then they would have the right to claim this property regardless of any survey, regardless of what had happened, as long as they had owned it openly, notoriously, and adversely to the world. Now, how does that fit into this?
I see it as a... Justice Bradley raised the issue of finality. You raised the issue of finality. We're talking horror stories of 50, 70 years.
Well,
and the finality is provided by the adverse possession statute that typically the problem ceases after 20 years. And it's principally because the damages go away. Because now you own the property. Now, still there's potentially some damages because you might have to defend that lawsuit because they're going to rely upon the survey. But the finality in the real estate area comes from the adverse possession statute.
So the property owner has finality, but the surveyor can be sued 80 years later. Is that it?
Probably right, but the property owner will have very little damage because they now own the property. And they say, what's your loss? You got what you thought you're getting. You don't have any damages. So then I got to dream up some damage, saying, well, they wouldn't have sued me. And so that part, yes, theoretically, yes.
In fact, under your theory, I say 80 years, it's unlimited. It's
right.
Ad infinitum.
Yeah, you got people, just like, you know, most victims eventually die and don't bring lawsuits. But unless they live forever.
Or successor liability of the surveying company.
Successor liability, right. And, you know, I don't think it's a public policy to say that the surveyors are unique, that they shouldn't be responsible for their liability.
Well, you know, maybe a different argument you might raise is some of these statutes that deal with not accrual, but a particular act, date the running of the statute of limitations from an act, they then say, well, if you discovered the damage within 6 months from the running of the statute of limitations and statute of repose, or 3 years, the one on the builders does from the 8th to the 10th year, then the statute of limitations is extended for another, and they vary. What do you say? So it seems to me, why aren't you arguing? It's a stretch, but... maybe your other argument's a stretch, too. Why aren't you arguing that we should read that into the statute, that the other statutes have a grace period, and then we should have a grace period here?
I don't think you want to read in the statute. I send you down the hall to get that definition down to the legislature to define it. The point is that the court has now told the legislature what is a cause of action, okay? And we position that fulcrum of justice to say an essential component is that the person know. Now, equal protection says that's where it starts, and we got six-year statutes out there, whatever they are, and the legislature can go down as they did in the medical mail, and I'm not going to address that in view of Mako's in front of this court, but they can go down in the medical mail case and say, hey, we're going through the statute of limitations, and we're going to say that when the discovery rule applies, thou shalt bring your action within 1 year, 6 months, whatever. That's how you solve the problem right now, because the court has defined when the cause of action accrues, an essential component of the cause of action, the normal 6 years applies. I agree, it's too long. Once you know your problem, get them to court.
But I don't think this court should do that. I think the legislature should do that now that this court told the legislature what in fundamental fairness is required for the administration of the folks that come here, individuals.
Mr. Bickler, it seems to me that the touchstone of the Hansen case is the court said this court has the power to establish when claims accrue. And that was key language in Hansen, and I know there's some broader language used in the decision, but some key language was that the statute started running at the time of accrual, and the court interpreted what time of accrual meant, and they said it includes date of discovery. What gives this court authority to put date of accrual into this statute? Now, I understand there's a constitutional argument, but putting that aside, under what theory can we put date of accrual, date of discovery into a statute that's very clear on its face that it's 6 years after the event?
You're not putting it into the statute. You have defined, in my view, as I read hence, what constitutes a cause of action in Wisconsin, a right to come to court, and inherent in the fundamental fairness underlying Hansen.
So we can trump the legislature and say, even though you use very clear language, legislature, and nothing, we don't have to interpret anything, we don't think this is fair, fundamental fairness, so we're going to read into here the discovery rule. Is that...
That's basically what the court is saying. We've always defined causes of action. We got rid of immunity. We can, you know, say, you should have acted. You didn't. Doggone it. We're going to do what's fair. And we finally did it. And that's what's fair. And until legislature, if you don't think the way individual rights are determined in Wisconsin need shortening, then go back. And all of these statutes, this one, it predates the recognition in Wisconsin of what is fair to the individual citizens, and that is, you got a right to get to this courthouse, and the door can't be closed before you know that you got it. That's where you should be going.
Well, we can't just say the statute isn't fair. I mean, there's no analytical framework.
We'd like to sometimes.
Yeah, we'd like to say that. But if the statute says you can't do this, whatever it is, we can't say, well, that's unfair, therefore we throw it out. We've got to put it in an analytical framework. Are you making a due process argument when you talk about fundamental fairness?
At that point, you're saying, at that point, when we say, the court says, this is fundamental fairness of a cause of action in Wisconsin. And if your statutes of repose, folks down the hall, your statutes of repose prohibit citizens from this of this state to get to this courthouse, now we have a serious constitutional question. Now I'm starting to talk about Section 1-9. Your special immunity legislation has blocked these folks from the courthouse.
Mr. Bickler, what if the statute had said a 4-year statute of limitations plus 1 year after that for discovery, but under no circumstances not longer than 5 years? Is that fundamentally fair? Is that a problem with that? If they had taken into consideration discovery and extended a statute of limitations an extra year.
I hate to be facetious, but do you want me to answer that question in view of the four decisions in Makos?
And how...
But that's the problem. That's the problem. When we get a gruesome fact situation like Makos, everybody shouts up and says, this is fundamentally unfair. We can't agree on how we get the fairness. But it's fundamentally unfair, and I think if the court backs up one step and says, really, you know what we're talking about? We define what is fairness to the individuals of this state, and when you do things that keep people out of the courthouse, then we got a real serious constitutional question.
Just a minute. So then, if I'm hearing you right, I mean, if your position is that, you know, that somewhere in Makos, that's fundamentally unfair also, then there can be no cap on it. You have to have a date of discovery, even if it occurs 100 years down the road, and that the legislature cannot close the courthouse door to somebody if they didn't reasonably discover it beforehand. Is that your position?
Well, I don't know if I have to take Makos 100 years, but, you know, the problem is, I think...
When does it become fundamentally fair to close courthouse doors on somebody who has not discovered their injury?
I think if we take Section 1-9... was meaning, as I think was one of just I think it was Crooks was saying what it means. If when you get to the point where the principal culprit, such as Bailey, such as the pathologist in Makos, can't be sued, and the victim could not have known of it, then I think I got a place for the use of Section 1.9, because at that point, the court says, this poor victim was kept out of the courthouse by something that legislature
did. Where's the top cap on that? Where's the top cap? What if somebody reasonably doesn't discover it for 50 years?
Let me ask that in a different way.
I hate to, I got a lot of problems with my current case. I didn't think out 50 years, but, you know, theoretically you want to take it down to logical arguments.
Well, as I understand it, you take the position that even if there was a grace period for discovery, if it still closes the door on a plaintiff, then it's still unconstitutional.
Well, that's the result of Mako's. You know, we got two decisions here. We got a different interpretation of the statute. We got two dissenters. So, you know, to whom do I speak on that issue?
Well, we didn't think it applied, so.
Yeah, I know.
Counselor, your argument would cover a lot of statutes. 893.85 talks about 10 years after the date of filing of a certificate. 893.86 talks about a statute of repose of 10 years after a reporting of a claim. 893.88 talks about a paternity of a child shall be commenced within 19 years of the date of the birth of the child.
I'm not sure I'm going that far unless all those are characterized as his torts. Because Hansen limits itself to tort claims.
Well, but these...
Oh, and I don't... I haven't analyzed
might
that.
Be, I can read probably from the tort... Statute 2, the 893, I think it's 89, action for injury resulting from improvement to real estate.
That's the statute we're talking
That's
about,
right.
Which they've tried a number of times to get up to speed, and they never got it up to equal protection standards.
No, that's
in this case, too.
We haven't gotten to equal protections yet. We're just dealing with you on how to read the statute. That deals with substantial completion. It does have a discovery kick in, not a discovery kick in, but a time kick in on that. But I'm sure if I went through it, I could find others that deal with an act. So if we take you, that really covers any tort statute.
I think you start with tort, then you look at the question of for a statute to have hope with what the court decided in Hansen, namely that it's fundamentally unfair to bar anybody, then you have to look at a statute that came in existence after, because you can't assume, as in this case, what was passed in 1979 addressed the fundamental unfairness. And Hansen says, unless the legislature has weighed that balance and positioned the fulcrum across the board, the discovery rule applies.
Counsel, I want to get back to what I think are the basics.
I got a question.
Assume that the law is, with regard to statutes of limitations and statutes of repose, that if you discover it within the period of limitation or within the period of repose, that you have to bring your lawsuit or it is barred. If you discover your injury within a 3-year statute of limitations, you have to bring it within 3 years, or after 3 years, it's barred. Assume that's the law. You have conceded that your clients discovered this injury 2 months before the running of the statute of repose. Under my assumed interpretation of the law, what happens to your lawsuit?
I'm out of court, but your assumption is wrong.
What's wrong with my assumption?
Your assumption is that, I'll give you the assumption. 1 minute before midnight, I swear, doggone it, 1 minute before midnight in 3 years, it was absolutely impossible.
Let's take your case. 2 months, not 1 minute. You have stated in your affidavit, you've conceded it here, that it was discovered in June of 1994, 2 months before the statute of repose ran. Why shouldn't you be barred from
doing this? Because in Hansen we said that every cause of action accrues with its discovery. And only when you have an accrued cause of action can you come to the courthouse.
But Hansen dealt with a case where the statute of limitations had already run. It was beyond the 3 years.
It makes no difference.
Mr. Beckler, before your time is up, Will you summarize for us your argument as to why there's a violation of equal protection by the statute?
In brief, there's absolutely no way of distinguishing this from Woolen's Plump. Specifically, Mrs. Wolford continued as a party defendant. All three folks misrepresented where this ground was. The innocent one, Mrs. Wolford, who hired a surveyor and a real estate agent to get rid of her vacant ground, ended up being liable with no defense, clearly subject to the discovery rule. And why should she be treated differently than the surveyor who's the culprit? That is unequal protection of the law in its clearest form, and that is exactly what happened in this case, and that's what Funk and Woolen said.
Well, your opponent says that there is an economic rational basis, and I suppose he could make two or three economic arguments, but how do you answer that?
He says there's an economic rational basis?
Yeah, when I asked him, he said there's a lot of, a surveyor does a lot of surveys in the course of the year, and to hold them open for liability on 100 different surveys, odd and forever, until they're discovered, simply the cost of doing business would just be too great.
The solution, of course, is accurate surveys. You don't have
what?
Accurate surveys?
Well, yeah, but, you know, okay. We can be off by negligence. I mean, you keep talking about misrepresentation, but
right.
I assume this is a negligence.
Well, it's a form of misrepresentation, negligence. Okay,
but
it's basically negligence of a surveyor. And he's trying to say there's an economic rational basis for the survey.
He's saying, I mean, you were here when he made the argument, because I asked him. He said that a rational basis exists for one. He gave a number of reasons in his brief, but the one that he gave here today was that it was an economic basis, that a surveyor does, if I'm quoting him correctly, a surveyor does 100 different surveys during the course of the year. And to say that surveyor is going to be held liable for an indefinite period of time into the future, 50 to 100 years or more, for each one of those surveys, would make the cost of his doing business much too great. And that's why they distinguish between the surveyor and the property owner. That's why the legislature did.
Well, that's
just add to that, Mr. Bickler. That's an argument that was made in medical malpractice, and the court has accepted
yes.
that.
In medical mail cases, the issue was addressed by the legislature until we got to Mekas. Okay? And there's where there was an argument made as to why. Medical mail, you got 3 years automatic personal injury. Then they grappled with the unfairness. They extended the time up to 5 with discovery. And then they cut it off. And then Mekas comes along and said, this is so unfair that Mekas is reversed. Now, economically, I think any tort feasor can win that argument. I didn't spend much time on it because I thought he was shooting up clay pigeons and I didn't see any ducks going overhead that need to be addressed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bickler. Mr. Fox?
Allow me to start with the contention that this is a misrepresentation case against poor Mrs. Wolford, because I wish I had represented her. It was not a misrepresentation case. She cannot be liable for misrepresentation, for pointing out survey markers, or giving someone else a survey. The three elements common to all three forms of misrepresentation in this state are that a representation was made, that it was untrue, and that it was relied on. It is not untrue to say that is a marker placed by my surveyor. According to him, that's my property line. There was no misrepresentation, valid claim made against Mrs. Wolford. And that's important because it seriously mitigates the equal protection effect that this has. Because
the seller can't be sued, you're saying.
The seller can be sued, but the seller is going to win that case because she's got an affirmative defense that she made no untrue representation.
All right. So your position is the seller is not liable.
That's my position.
The buyer.
Now, even going to the Mekas issue, this is not a Mekas case, and I think it's clear that Mekas is not precedent because of the plurality decision. But even if this was a Mekas case, the doors to the courthouse were not slammed shut on these people before they discovered their harm. They had almost 3 months to file suit. Not a long period of time, but not the one day that existed in Martin.
You've got to make that argument in this case because that's your client's position, but we're writing on a far broader slate, and we're concerned about the person that discovers. Of course, we're concerned about your clients or their clients in this position, but we're also concerned about people who don't discover their injury within the 3 years or the 6 years, whatever the period is. They discover it 6 months after, and the door of the courthouse is closed to them.
That may be a legitimate concern. I won't concede that in this case, but it also, by the same token, may not be right for this court to decide in this case because those facts just aren't before this court, and they never have been. And even it also goes to equal protection because the equal protection aspects aren't implicated because the statute wasn't triggered until after they had the notice that's been considered so important by the Toms Acts.
Article 1, Section 9 has been talked about, but was hardly mentioned, if at all, in the briefs. I'm not even sure it was. Do you think if we were to look at this as an Article 1, Section 9 case, it needs further briefing?
No, I don't. I think it's all in there, because Article 1, Section 9 is very clear, and it was illuminated very well by the Makos case, and that is, I believe, a valid interpretation of Article 1, Section 9, but it just doesn't apply to the facts of this case.
Why?
Article 1, Section 9, and the way the Makos court, Justice Steinmetz, wrote that decision,